White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of Henry Ford's The International Jew. This is the study hour on Thursday, December 6, 2012, and I'm Carolyn Yeager here with co-host Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Hi, Hadding. Well, I want to tell the listeners, I have to make a little announcement here, that we are starting a new chapter tonight, chapter 19. But before we do, I have to tell people, if you'll bear with me, that I am trying to say some things about my website, CarolynYeager.net. And I'm trying to go totally to CarolynYeager.net and exclude the .com as an option, even though it would point to that. But the two have gotten confused and seems like in some ways there's two domains, even though they're the same thing. But anyway, there's reasons for it, so please change my email address, folks, to carolyn@carolynyeager.net. I realize this is not the best place to announce this, but I will be announcing it everywhere, so I wanted to do it here, too. That goes for tonight, too. If you want to write in, to do it to carolyn@carolynyeager.net, and you can also call in, this is also a call-in show. The number is 830, starting with a 1, 1-830-443-4911. Okay, and I apologize for the confusion.
That's on the White Network site, too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's at the top of the upper right-hand corner where you click to listen to the program live. So, that's all. There's one other thing. I got a Christmas card in our mailbox a few days ago, and, this person has really been enjoying, the International Jew Study Hour, and wanted to say that he or she really enjoys, this was totally anonymous, this card. No, I don't know who it's from. They really enjoy your reading, on the program, Hadding, but they think you're a little silly on some other issues. But they do enjoy your reading, and yeah, I'm sure
I don't think
enjoys your reading.
There's no way to satisfy everybody on this.
You're right. But I want you should realize that a lot of our listeners see it pretty much the way I do. But that's not. I'm not.
Yeah. Well, they need to learn a few things.
Okay. But this person likes and wants us to keep up the high standards that we have on the White Network and wishes a Merry Christmas to Tan Staffel too. So isn't that nice? It was, and a little bit of cash in there. This was like, not very much, but a few, like they opened up their wallet and saw what they could spare and stuck it in there. It's kind of nice. Very touching. All right. Chapter 19, Hadding.
Yeah. The All-Jewish Mark on Red Russia. We shall now briefly interrupt the commentary.
Well, isn't there a little quote there at the beginning?
My edition.
Well, I think it's something that is repeated in the chapter, so we don't have to do it. Okay.
I'm using the 4-volume edition.
Yeah, well, I'm using the one from the internet, which is also the 4-volume, but there seems to be a few things that are different. So,
mm-hmm.
Are you reading from an actual book?
No, I have a PDF. It's a reproduction of the 4-volume edition
That
was available. There's a 4-volume edition, and then there's another edition that's all in one volume.
Oh, well, I have the 4-volume. It should be the same, but obviously it's not. Different people maybe post it and then they do it different.
Well, we came across before where there was a word in your edition that wasn't in mine.
Yes,
or something
right.
Like.
That's what I'm thinking of.
All right. So there's no quote in mine. If you you have a quote that's it's actually just an excerpt from the text, huh?
Well, I think it might be, because it seemed like I saw it repeated. No, that's in the next chapter when that where that is. Maybe I'll read it real quick. In a world, it doesn't say, though, who it's by, so it must be from the text. In a world of completely organized territorial sovereignties, he, the Jew, has only two possible cities of refuge.
Okay.
He must either pull down the pillars. Do you have that? He must either pull down the pillars of the whole national state system, or he must create a territorial sovereignty of his own. In Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism seem to grow side by side. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system is ever anything but distasteful to him.
Yeah, I remember we ran across that very early.
Yeah, and that was one of these
some Englishmen.
Guys. That's right. That's right.
Some Englishmen said that.
Right.
All right. The all-Jewish, that's on the page before this chapter begins.
Okay. And they obviously they think this relates to the upcoming chapter here.
The all-Jewish mark on Red Russia. We shall now briefly interrupt the commentary which we have been making on the protocols to set at rest once and for all certain misstatements which are made for Gentile consumption. To learn what the Jewish leaders of the United States or any other country think, do not read their addresses to the Gentiles, read their addresses to their own people. On such matters as these, whether the Jew regards himself as destined to rule the world, whether he regards himself as belonging to a nation and race distinct from every other nation and race, whether he regards the Gentile world as the legitimate field of his exploitation by a lower moral method than is permissible among his own people, whether he knows and shares the principles of the protocols, on such matters as these, the only safe guide is to be found in the words which Jewish leaders speak to Jews, not in the words they speak to Gentiles.
Right.
The notable Jewish names which appear oftenest in the press do not represent the spokesmen of Judaism at all, but only a selected few who represent the Department of Propaganda among the Gentiles. Propaganda among the Gentiles. That's the name of the department. Sometimes that propaganda is in the form of donations for Christian charitable organizations. Sometimes it is in the form of liberal opinion on religious, social, and political questions. In whatever form it comes, you may depend upon it that the real activities of the Jewish hierarchy proceed under cover of that which the Gentile is invited to observe and approve.
Undercover, right, meaning that the Gentile is not supposed to see it. Right.
Play games to distract your attention from what's really happening. The statements offered in this series are never made without the strictest and fullest proof, confirmation and corroboration in the utterances of Jewish leaders.
Well, there's that sentence that I mentioned to you. And
this is one of the strange features of the multitude of Jewish attacks on this series. They are attacking what they themselves stand for. And their only reason for the attack must be their belief that this investigation has not been able to penetrate through to that which has been kept hidden from the world. The most persistent denials have been offered to the statement that Bolshevism everywhere, in Russia or the United States, is Jewish. In these denials, we have perhaps one of the most brazen examples of the double intent referred to above. The denial of the Jewish character of Bolshevism is made to the Gentile, but in the confidence and secrecy of Jewish communication, or buried in the Yiddish dialect, or obscurely hidden in the Jewish national press, we find the proud assertion made to their own people that Bolshevism is Jewish.
Okay, can I break in here? Because okay. I'd like to mention that when they said here, the statements offered in this series are never made without the strictest and fullest proof, confirmation, and corroboration in the utterances of Jewish leaders. And then that brought to my mind that Montefiore statement, which we mentioned last week, and I think it was in the previous chapter then. So it may be, it just occurred to me now, that there were, at first I thought they were referring to that, among other things, and then now it occurs to me that maybe when that chapter came out, maybe they got some comments or questions about that quote by Moses Montefiore, which you said, and I had to agree, didn't have any foundation.
Well, I just don't know. I don't know.
I don't either. But they seem that they seem to, they might be referring to that, although they don't point it out. But that they are telling us that they check this stuff out, and they're convinced of it, but maybe there wasn't any.
It's that it was published by somebody somewhere. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. There are a lot of fake quotes around.
Yeah, but it may, or it may be that he said it out loud, and people said he said it, but they couldn't actually give a source for it. I don't know.
Apocryphal.
But yeah, well, it's questionable for that reason. You're right. But they are saying here that I think they might be referring to that among maybe some other things.
If anybody can find the text where those Montefiore quotes were originally printed, please tell us what it was.
It was just one. It was just that one short one.
There was another one earlier.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Two of them. Two of them that weren't sourced anywhere, huh?
I believe.
Well, I was reading about that Montefiore. I read his diary or whatever, his journal from the time of the Damascus affair. A long thing I had to plow through. And he sounds like he's capable of anything like that. Yeah. He's really pro-Jewish.
Yeah.
Really a servant of the Jews.
Well, he was a Jew.
Well, I know. And I mean, his whole life was based around helping Jews and this Jewish philanthropy stuff.
Yeah.
So
Jewish propaganda has only two straws to grasp in the terrible tale of murder, immorality, robbery, enforced starvation, and hideous humanism, which make the present Russian civilization impossible to destroy.
Situation.
I didn't say the present Russian situation. Yeah. Impossible to describe, and all but impossible to comprehend. One of these straws is that Kerensky, the man who eased in the opening wedge of Bolshevism, is not a Jew. Indeed, one of the strongest indications that Bolshevism is Jewish is that the Jewish press emphasizes so fiercely the alleged Gentilism of at least two of the revolutionary notables. It may be cruel to deny them two among hundreds, but merely saying so cannot change Kerensky's nationality. His name is Adler. His father was a Jew, and his mother a Jewess. Adler, the father, died, and the mother married a Russian named Kerensky, whose name the young child took. Among the radicals who employed him as a lawyer, among the forces that put him forward to drive the first nail into Russia's cross, among the soldiers who fought with him, his Jewish descent and character have never been doubted. I think this is slightly inaccurate here. I believe it was his mother's father who was named Adler.
Well, no. Well, I've got something here that it was Lenin's mother's father who was Jewish.
Yes, that's true.
Well, yeah. I don't know if you can find this story the way that they're giving it here, because they try to change as much stuff as they can. But I'll have to look that up. I just took this. I was doing some study on Lenin today rather than Kerensky.
Yeah, I think they've got the details crossed there, but I did find that there was a former KGB agent. He wrote a book called The Inside KGB, The Inside Story of Its Foreign Operations from Lenin to Gorbachev. And Gordievsky, in his book, says that Kerensky was a Jew.
Well, we have to remember that this is closer to this time that this is written, and that we learned right in the beginning that Ford's team was all included detectives, professional detectives, and professional investigators and so on, along with these writers. So I think they had detectives go out and travel around and check things out and talk to people and so on. They don't just sit and, you know, do research. Of course, they didn't have the internet, but now we just sit on the internet and look things up for the most part. But you can find a lot. Find a lot on the internet. But anyway.
Well, there is Lenin, our Jewish publicists say. Lenin, the head of it all, the brains of it all, and Lenin is a Gentile. We've got you there. Lenin is a Gentile. You know, it didn't come out until decades later, I think, that he was actually a quarter Jew.
Yeah, that's what he is.
Perhaps he is, but why do his children speak Yiddish? Why are his proclamations put forth in Yiddish? Why did he abolish the Christian Sunday and establish by law the Jewish Saturday Sabbath? The explanation of all this may be that he married a Jewess. The fact is that he did. But another explanation may be that he himself is a Jew. Certainly he is not the Russian nobleman he has always claimed to be. The statements he has made about his identity thus far have been lies. The claim that he is a Gentile may be unfounded, too. They actually were right about that.
Yeah, they are. And let's look at this and tell people that, he wrote... Well, this is something else. But why do I have this here? I don't know. Oh, this is just interesting about Lenin. Okay, about his Jewishness, but I did find in Wikipedia that his mother's father was Jewish. So like you said, he's one quarter Jewish. But Lenin was born in 1870, which puts him, 30 years old in 1900, when all that protocols information was making itself available, and in Russia it was quite the talk. So he was familiar with all of that, and he was enthusiastic, it says, about the radio and gramophone. And in 1919 he recorded 8 speeches, and 7 of them were published under Khrushchev, but the 8th one was not, and it outlined Lenin's thoughts on anti-Semitism. And here's an excerpt from it, if it's not the whole, no, it couldn't be the whole thing. He says that here's his attitude toward Jews, Lenin. The Tsar, in 1919 already, the Tsarist police, in alliance with the landowners and the capitalists, organized pogroms against the Jews. The landowners and capitalists tried to divert the hatred of the workers and peasants who were tortured, by the police, against the Jews. It is not the Jews who are the enemies of the working people. The enemies of the workers are the capitalists of all countries. Yeah. Among the Jews, there are working people, and they form the majority. Can you imagine the majority of the Jews are working people? They are our brothers who, like us, are oppressed by capital. They are our comrades in the struggle for socialism. The capitalists strive to sow and foment hatred between workers of different faiths, different nations, and different races. Rich Jews, like rich Russians and the rich in all countries, are in alliance to oppress, crush, rob, and disunite the workers. Shame on the... Whoops, something's in my way. Shame on those who foment hatred towards the Jews, who foment hatred towards other nations. So he was there to, the Jews were special. I mean, they were more than just equal. They were kind of special to Lenin. And, of course, he was surrounded by them.
Of course, when he talks about capitalists there, he's talking about industrialists probably, not bankers.
There you go, because that absolutely that whole thing was financed by the bankers.
No one has ever doubted Trotsky's nationality. He is a Jew. His name is Braunstein. Recently, the Gentiles were told that Trotsky had said he wasn't much of anything in religion. That may be, but he still must be something. Else why are the Russian Christian churches turned into stables, slaughterhouses, and dancing halls, while the Jewish synagogues remain untouched? And why are Christian priests and ministers made to work on the roads, while Jewish rabbis are left their clerical privileges? Trotsky may not be much of anything in religion, but he is a Jew nevertheless. This is not mere Gentile insistence that he shall be considered a Jew whether or no. It is straight Jewish teaching that he is. In a future discussion on religion or race, we shall show that even without religion, Trotsky is and is considered by all Jewish authorities to be a Jew.
I guess there was some question about that at the time, how maybe they were trying
well,
to deny
they do that all the time.
Trotsky
say,
well, was.
It, you know, Jews will say that they're not Jews on the premise that they don't go to synagogue. You know.
Right. Yeah, like it's because they want to make it into a religion.
Well, it depends on whatever's convenient at the moment. When it's convenient, oh, yes, I'm a Jew. When it's not convenient, oh, I'm not a Jew.
Yeah, exactly.
Just use a different definition of the word. An apology must be made here for repeating well-known facts. Yet so many people are not even now aware of the true meaning of Bolshevism that at the risk of monotony, we shall cite a few of the salient facts. The purpose, however, is not alone to explain Russia, but to throw a warning light on conditions in the United States. The Bolshevik government, as it stood late this summer when the latest report was smuggled through to certain authorities, shows up the Jewish domination of the whole affair. It has changed very slightly since the beginning. We give only a few items to indicate the proportion. It must not be supposed that the non-Jewish members of the government are Russian. Very few Russians have anything to say about their country these days. The so-called dictatorship of the proletariat, in which the proletariat has nothing whatever to say, is Russian only in the sense that it is set up in Russia. It is not Russian in that it springs from or includes the Russian people. It is the international program of the protocols, which might be put over a minority in any country, and which is being given a dress rehearsal in Russia.
Yeah, which might be put over by a minority in any country.
Yeah.
It's funny how, what was, I wonder how many instances that could be, we could come up with, in which a minority took over a country. Of the regular people.
Well, fact is that every revolution is accomplished by a small minority.
Okay, that's right. You know, so that's something
usually,
to think
usually
about.
Single-digit percentages of the population that are involved in any revolution.
And how much preparation do you think they need? How much priming of the public or whatever before they can manage to just take it over?
Well...
You have to get control of certain things.
The essence of the public, indifference.
Yeah, that's it. That's what allows it. And I suppose the larger the public you have, like the Russians, they were this big, huge, millions and millions of ignorant peasants. I mean, really ignorant. And who, you know, didn't have any schooling or any knowledge, and they just followed the church and what their priest told them, and then what the government told them they had to do, and they didn't think about anything, really. And so they were just, they didn't even know what was going on, you know. They and then they were slaughtered, so many of them. This is like sheep.
Okay, well, next page is a chart or a table, the list. Table showing Jewish control of Russia. And the first column is the commissariats. The second column is the number of members that are in the commissariat. Then you have the number of Jewish members and the percentage. See, in the council of the commissaries of the people, 17 out of 22 are Jews. That's 77.2%. In the commissariat of war, 33 out of 43 are Jews. That's 76.7%. Commissariat of foreign affairs, 13 out of 16 are Jews. 81.2%. Commissariat of finance, 24 out of 30 are Jews. That's 80%. Commissariat of Justice, 20 out of 21 are Jews. That's 95.2%.
They didn't trust any non-Jews with the questions of justice, looks like.
Yeah. Well, Jews know all about justice. You know that. Commissariat of Public Instruction, 42 out of 53 were Jews. That's 79%. Commissariat of Social Assistance, 6 out of 6 were Jews. Commissariat of Work, 7 out of 8 were Jews. The delegates of the Bolshevik Red Cross to Berlin, Vienna, Varsovia, Bucharest, and Copenhagen, 8 out of 8 were Jews.
Wow. So that's 200% so far.
Yeah. Commissaries of the provinces, 21 out of 23 were Jews. That's 91.3%. And among journalists, 41 out of 41 are Jews.
That's three that are 100%. The journalists were Jews. What does that mean? My gosh.
It means they control the information.
Well, they're all Jews in the United States now, I would say.
That's an overstatement, but
of course it is. But you might as well they might as well be that way. Almost, you know.
Well, it actually things could be a lot worse. But all this had changed to a considerable degree during Stalin's period.
I have some figures from Stalin's period. It took a while for Stalin's period.
Instead of being 80 to 100% Jews in all these various departments, it was down to around 50% in a lot of them.
Gee.
Which is still a lot, but
just still too much. But you know that this, they're writing about Bolshevism, you know, and this is what started in 1918-19. So that's what they're talking about. That Bolshevism is Jewish, and it was, wasn't it?
Well, it was led by Jews. I can say that for sure, at least initially.
Well, not only led by Jews. Look at all these people. All these commissariats are made up. Almost
yeah,
totally
it was led
true.
By Jews, and they put Jews in key positions.
Wow.
These are enlightening figures. The reader will note that the Jewish percentage is high at all times, never lower than 76% in any case. Curiously enough, the lowest percentage of Jews is found in the Commissariat of War. But in those committees which deal most closely with the mass of the people, as well as in the committees of defense and propaganda, Jews fill literally all the places.
I bet they had less of them in the Commissariat of War, even though that was very high, because what do the Jews know about war? So they needed to get a lot of probably Russians who had experience, you know, veterans or something who had experience in war, to know what the hell they were doing, what they kind of plans to make. Yeah.
Remember what the protocols say about press control. Remember what Baron Montefiore said about it. And then look at the government journalists. That committee comprises 41 men, and the 41 are Jews. Only Jewish pens are trusted with Bolshevist propaganda.
Very good. And so here I did stick in here this quote from Montefiore from the last chapter. And it says that when old Baron Moses Montefiore said at Krakow in Poland, "What are you prating about? As long as we do not have the press of the whole world in our hands, everything you may do is in vain." So he would have been talking only to Jews. "We must control or influence the papers of the whole world in order to blind and deceive the people." And the International Jew comments that he knew what he was saying, By blinding the people, he only meant that they should not see the Jew, and by deceiving them, he only meant that the people should think certain world movements meant one thing when they really meant another. So, with that in mind, he may have said it, but anyway, they want us.
We don't know what the source of that is.
I know we don't.
And then the so-called Red Cross delegates, which are merely Red Revolutionary delegates to the cities named. Of the eight, there are eight Jews. I can see how they taking control of the doling out of assistance could be a key position. The Commissariat of Social Assistance, upon whose word the life and privilege of tens of thousands hang, there are six members, and the six are Jews, and so on through the list. Out of the 53 members of the Commissariat of Public Instruction, 11 are noted as non-Jews. But what kind of non-Jews is not stated? They may be non-Jews like Lenin, whose children speak Yiddish as their native tongue.
Yeah, who actually is part Jewish, so you never know. Some of these non-Jews may have been part Jews, too.
Whatever they are, there is a sidelight upon their attitude in the fact that the Bolsheviki immediately took over all the Hebrew schools and continued them as they were, and laid down a rule that the ancient Hebrew language should be taught in them. The ancient Hebrew language is the vehicle of the deeper secrets of the world program.
That's
And for the Gentile Russian children, why, said these gentle Jewish educators, we shall teach them sex knowledge. We will brush out of their minds the cobwebs. They must learn the truth about things. With consequences that are too pitiable to narrate. But this can be said. Unquestionably, there were deaths among innocent Jews when Hungary wrested itself free from the red Bolshevism of Bela Kun or Cohen.
Well, I object to the word innocent there. They're still talking about innocent Jews. I realize there's Jews who aren't in charge, but I don't think that we should talk about innocent Jews at all, because they all go along with it. You know.
Well, the thing is, you get since they're a separate people with a separate set of interests, a lot of times the Jews will acquiesce in things that are horrendous for other people among whom they live. The Jews don't care about it, even though other people care about it. And that makes it look like they're supporting what's going on. And in a way, they are.
Yeah, and then, you know, people who don't want to be attacked as anti-Semites, like the Ford group there didn't, you know, every once in a while they would make some effort to say that, there are these good Jews and they hope they would stand up and speak out and so on. You know, because they don't want to be accused of just hating Jews. And so they add in this thing about innocent Jews. But I just wanted to point out that I wouldn't do that anymore. I think we shouldn't do that anymore. Nobody should do it. Make a rule. Make a law. Can't call
Well, I think it's also an important point that Jews were heavily involved in spreading Bolshevism outside of Russia, even if...
That's right. And we
even if the rank and file Bolsheviks in Russia were mostly not Jews. You find that in most of Eastern Europe. The Jews may well call it the white terror that followed their failure to reenact the tragedy of Russia in Hungary, but there are mountains of evidence to show that nothing had so potent an effect in producing the bloodshed of the white terror as the outraged minds of parents whose children had been compulsorily drawn through sloughs of filth during the short time the Jewish Bolsheviki had charge of the schools.
If you can talk to parents about what this Jewish education is doing, and we've got Jewish education in the United States now, And of course it's in Europe too, even though they don't call it that. But, you know, where they're teaching kids all these things, but they call it tolerance and progress and, you know, love and stuff instead of filth. But anyway, okay, sorry.
Multiculturalism and sex education.
Right.
American Jews do not like to hear this. Their shrinking from it would be greatly to their honor did they not immediately return to the defense of the people who do these things. See, those are your innocent Jews, I believe. It is well enough known that the chastity of Christians is not so highly regarded by the Orthodox male Jew as is the chastity of his own people. But it would be pleasant to be certain that all of them condemn what went on in Russia and Hungary in the matter of education. However, as most of the influences which destroy Gentile youth today in America are in the hands of the Jews, and as it is plainly stated in the protocols that one of the lines of campaign is to corrupt the youth of the Gentiles, the situation is one that calls for something more than mere hard feelings and angry denials whenever these facts are referred to.
Well, now, I think that's very good. And you have any comment on that? I mean, you know, what they're doing today to corrupt our youth, what they have been doing all along, calls for more than just hard feelings. And, oh, I know, he's talking about the Jews. I get that wrong. The situation is one that calls for something more than hard feelings and angry denials from the Jews when we bring these things up. But it also should call for more than just anger from Gentile people. They should take up arms to stop it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to bother them as much as it bothers some of us. It is not the economic experiment, so-called, that one objects to in Russia. It is not the fallacies, the sad delusion of the people. No, it is the downright dirty immorality, the brutish nastiness of it all. And the line which the immorality and nastiness draws between Jew and Gentile. The horrible cruelty involved we will not deal with, leaving it merely with the explanation which has found utterance in the Jewish press that it may be that the Jew in Russia is taking an unconscious revenge for his centuries of suffering. But, asks some reader, how may we know that all this is true? Bearing in mind that we are speaking of Russia, not for the interest of the Russian situation at all, but to indicate the international character of those who are responsible for conditions there, and to identify them for the protection of the United States, we shall look at the evidence. There is, of course, the evidence brought to light by our own United States Senate and printed in a report of the Committee on the Judiciary. We do not wish to spend much time on this because we prefer in these articles to use Jewish testimony instead of Gentile, but we shall pause long enough to show the nature of the testimony brought out by our own government. Now, I actually have parts of this guy's testimony on my blog, Dr. George A. Simons. Mm-hmm. Dr. George A. Simons, a clergyman in charge of an American congregation in Petrograd at the time the Bolshevik terror broke out, was a witness. Parts of his testimony are given here. There were hundreds of agitators who followed in the trail of Trotsky Bronstein, these men having come over from the Lower East Side of New York. A number of us were impressed by the strange Yiddish element in this thing right from the start, and it soon became evident that more than half the agitators in the so-called Bolshevik movement were Yiddish. Senator Nelson. Hebrews? Dr. Simons. They were Hebrews, apostate Jews. Apostate Jews.
Yeah.
I do not want to say anything against the Jews as such. I'm not in sympathy with the anti-Semitic movement, never have been, and do not ever expect to be, but I have a firm conviction that this thing is Yiddish, and that one of its bases is found in the east side of New York. Mm-hmm. Senator Nelson. Trotsky came over from New York during that summer, did he not, Dr. Simons? He did. Later, Dr. Simons said, in December 1918, under the presidency of a man known as Apfelbaum, out of 388 members, only 16 happened to be real Russians, and all the rest Jews, with the exception possibly of one man who is a Negro from America who calls himself Professor Gordon. And 265 of this northern commune government that is sitting in the old Smolny Institute came from the Lower East Side of New York. 265 of them.
Amazing, isn't it?
I might mention this, that when the Bolsheviki came into power, all over Petrograd, we at once had a predominance of Yiddish proclamations. Big posters, everything in Yiddish. It became very evident that now that was to be one of the great languages of Russia. And the real Russians, of course, did not take very kindly to it.
Well, now, before you go to that next person and his quotes, this Dr. George Simons, you know, it's great that he said all this. But now he's a clergyman, see? And he's stationed in, he's in Petrograd, Russia, because, you know, they go out and go all over the world. And so he was there and saw all this happening. But because he's a clergyman, a Christian, he has to say that he doesn't want to say anything against the Jews as such.
He's not
in sympathy with the anti-Semitic movement, never has been, and never expect to be. Now, I wonder, but he's going to see it as some faction of Jews who's behind all this, you know, and that's how he'll probably continue to see it. And I wonder, you know, we could hope that he had has taken a different attitude toward Jews, toward the anti-Semitism after all this, but he probably didn't, because people didn't, did they? You know, they find ways to explain that it's not all the Jews, it's not really Jews, it's something else, I don't know. You know, they just find their way around that. It's too bad.
Well, not everything that Simons said was accurate. I trust the things that Simons says that he saw with his own eyes, but a lot of the information that he gave in his testimony was hearsay. For example, that name Apfelbaum is not correct. I think that was supposed
that
to be the real name of...
Isn't that Trotsky's name?
Zinoviev, I think.
Oh, Zinoviev, okay.
Yeah, his real name was something like Rykovsky or something, not Apfelbaum.
Oh, I still read that Apfelbaum. I read that all over the place.
Yeah, I know. It's a very commonly...
Well, Rykovsky was an alias. I don't think you're right. I'm not sure you're right.
Well,
about that.
I couldn't
Rykovsky
find
Rykovsky was a Russian alias that he used, but his it still says that he was born Apfelbaum.
Who says?
Well, I think I read it even in Wikipedia, because I remember reading some of that stuff in Wikipedia, and I think
I tried to find that at some point. I could never get any verification that his real name was Apfelbaum.
Well, I read somewhere not too long ago that it wasn't that other name he had was an alias. He used quite a few Russian names, or at least he used that one along with Zinoviev. Okay.
And I also think that his numbers about the Northern Commune government might be inaccurate. What I've noticed, I've looked at a few different pieces of testimony or information like this out of Russia, and secondhand information is always dubious coming from this.
Well, probably true.
What I'm saying is
people exaggerate.
Simons, when he talks about what he saw himself, that he saw a bunch of Yiddish-speaking agitators standing on soapboxes. I believe that. I believe that he saw Yiddish language posters and so forth. But when he's repeating what he heard from other sources, it becomes dubious. Because the white Russians, the anti-Bolsheviks, were not above exaggerating things.
Well, sure. You're right.
All right. William Chapin Huntington, who was commercial attaché of the United States Embassy at Petrograd, testified, "The leaders of the movement, I should say, are about two-thirds Russian Jews. The Bolsheviks are internationalists, and they were not interested in the particular national ideals of Russia. William W. Welch, an employee of the National City Bank, New York, testified, "In Russia, it is well known that three-fourths of the Bolshevik leaders are Jewish. There were some, not many, but there were some real Russians. And what I mean by real Russians is Russian-born and not Russian Jews." Roger E. Simmons, trade commissioner connected with the United States Department of Congress, also testified.
Commerce.
I didn't say Congress.
No, you said Congress.
Commerce. Okay. My brain-to-mouth connection is not working right today. Also testified, an important anonymous witness whom the committee permitted to withhold his name told the same things. The British White Book on Russia, number one, a collection of reports on Bolshevism in Russia, presented to Parliament by command of His Majesty, April 1919, contains masses of the same testimony from many sources, all of them eyewitnesses. That you can actually find that on archive.org. In that very highly respected magazine, Asia, for February-March 1920, is an article which contains, among other important ones, these statements. The italics are ours. In all the Bolshevist institutions, the heads are Jews. The assistant commissar for elementary education, Grunberg, can hardly speak Russian. The Jews are successful in everything and obtain their ends. They know how to command and get complete submission. But they are proud and contemptuous toward everyone, which strongly excites the people against them. At the present time, there is a great national religious fervor among the Jews. They believe that the promised time of the rule of God's elect on earth is coming. They have connected Judaism with a universal revolution. They see in the spread of revolution the fulfilling of the scriptures. Though I make an end of all the nations, is a quote from the Bible, though I make an end of all the nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make an end of thee.
Of thee.
Now, if Gentile proof were wanted, the files of the Dearborn Independent for a whole year would not begin to contain it. But Jewish proof is better. There has been a strange vacillation in Jewish opinion concerning Bolshevism. At first, it was hailed with delight. There was no concealment whatever in the early days of the new regime as to the part which Jewry had in it. Public meetings, interviews, special articles poured forth in which very valuable elements of truth were mingled. There was no attempt at concealment of names. Then the horror of the thing began to take hold upon the world, and for just a breathing space, Jewish opinion fell silent. There was a spasmodic denial or two, then a new burst of glorification. The glorification continues within Judaism itself, but it now carries on the Gentile side of its face, a very sad expression labeled persecution. We have lived to see the day when to denounce Bolshevism is to persecute the Jews. In the American Hebrew for September 10th, 1920, an article appears which not only acknowledges and explains the part which the Jew plays in the present unrest and upheaval, but justifies it, and justifies it, curiously enough, by the Sermon on the Mount. The writer says that the Jew evolved organized capitalism with its working instrumentality, thus the banking system. This is very refreshing in view of the numerous Jewish denials of this economic fact. One of the impressive phenomena of the impressive time is the revolt of the Jew against Frankenstein, against the Frankenstein, which his own mind conceived and his own hand fashioned. In other words, Jews revolting against capitalism. If this is true, why is Jewish organized capital with its working instrumentality, the banking system, supporting the revolt?
Yeah. So they're saying that Jews are revolting against something that they created, which was capitalism. But it's the organized capital in the form of the banking system that's supporting it. Okay, well, that's comment is by the International Jew people.
Okay. That achievement, referring to Russian overthrow, destined to figure in history as the overshadowing result of the World War, was largely the outcome of Jewish thinking, of Jewish discontent, of Jewish effort to reconstruct. This rapid emergence of the Russian Revolution from the destructive phase and its entrance into the constructive phase is a conspicuous expression of the constructive genius of Jewish discontent. And that was in the American Hebrew for September 10th, 1920.
Yeah, see, they were already turning it into something great that the Jews were doing.
Yep.
Instead of denying that the Jews were in it. They denied it first, but they couldn't keep it up, so they turned it around.
Yeah. Okay. This, of course, requires proof that the constructive phase has appeared. The implication here is sheer propaganda. The protocols, however, have a reconstructive program. We have not reached it as yet in this series of articles, but it is clearly outlined in the protocols. Destroy Gentile society and then reconstruct it according to our plans. Now read carefully. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries.
The same historic qualities.
What?
I said the same historic qualities.
What did I say?
That's what you said. No, you said that, but I mean, that's kind of interesting.
Okay. Read that again. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia? Just what was that? And just how did it powerfully contribute? And why are Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent always linked together? If you read the protocols, it is all very clear. Jewish idealism is the destruction of Gentile society and the erection of Jewish society. Was it not so in Russia? Yiddish proclamations on the walls, the ancient Hebrew in the schools, Saturday substituted for Sunday, and the rabbis respected while the priests were put to work on the roads, all powerfully contributed to by murder, rapine, theft, and starvation. Our author is more candid than he realizes. He calls this linked idealism and discontent the historic qualities of the Jewish mind. The Dearborn Independent is indebted to him for this clear confirmation of what it has been saying for some time. But even that is not all. These same historic qualities of the Jewish mind, which contributed so powerfully to accomplish in Russia the Red Terror still existing there, are declared by this author to be tending to promote the same sort of thing in other countries. He says so in so many words, tending to promote in other countries. But we knew that. The only difference is that when Gentiles say it, they were overwhelmed. When Gentiles said it, they were overwhelmed with the wildest abuse. But now a pro-Jewish writer says it in a leading Jewish publication, and he says it apologetically. Listen to him. It was natural that discontent in other parts of the world should find expression in overemphasis of issues and overstatement of aims. What discontent? Jewish discontent, of course. Discontent with what? With any form of Gentile rule. And how did it find expression? In overemphasis of issues and overstatement of aims. What were these issues and aims? to bring the Bolshevik Revolution to the United States. No, they did not overstate their aims. They exactly stated them. They simply selected the wrong country, that's all. There are Russian Bolshevists in this country now, hawking about the streets of New York the gold cigarette cases which they stole from Russian families, and the family jewels, the wedding and birthday rings, which they filched from Russian women. Bolshevism never got further than the pawn shop and the burglar's fence idea. The proof of this traffic in stolen property is going to drive some people into hiding before long. It will be a long, long time before America will be taking orders in Yiddish, or American women will be giving up their jewels to the chosen race. However, that happens to be only the most recent acknowledgement that has come to hand. It is significant for its confession that Jewish discontent was tending to promote in other countries what it has so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia. And with such a link between the American Hebrew, Russian Bolshevism, and the protocols, there are still Jewish publicists with the crust to say that only crazy people could see the connection. Only blind people will not see it. But that is only a minor connection. This series of articles does not rest on anything so accidental as this Jewish New Year's apology for Bolshevism in the great Hebrew Weekly of the United States.
Very good, Hattie. And that is the end of chapter 19. Which was came out on the 25th of September, 1920. So they like to get into the current periodicals. Oh, and now this in this chapter, they're talking about the what was in the American Hebrew. But, you know, it's just kind of amazing. I mean, it's really a great benefit to be able to read what they were saying in 1920 about what had just happened in Russia and it was going on and what they expected from it and so on. But they did say they wanted to bring it to the United States, which is what Henry Ford's real concern is. He's trying to save the United States of America from this, from all this Judaism. But what comment would you like to make in the last minute here? To
well, I think it would have been nice if the last couple of paragraphs there would have been better if he talked about the link between the American Hebrew and Russian Bolshevism and not said, and the protocols.
Well, you can link all three together.
Yeah.
Well, you can certainly link the protocols to Russian Bolshevism. So that's just your bias. It's not.
Yeah, I'm the only one that says protocols are not authentic. Okay.
Well, but that's still a bias. I mean, it doesn't mean that it doesn't fit there. It does fit. So it's too bad you had to end with that. ladies and gentlemen, we're about over here. Next week we're coming to chapter 20, Jewish testimony in favor of Bolshevism. So this one was, you know, like, it was, well, what was it called? Man. Well, it was showing that, that Red Russia was put together by Jews, was a Jewish endeavor. But now we're going to see what the Jews say in favor of Bolshevism. In this chapter 20, which brings us to the end of book one of the four books. Right, Hattie?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So we'll see you next week, folks. Come back.
All right, y'all.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.